The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 238, The Way It Was, a look at D. Michael Quinn's Same-Sex Dynamics in 19th Century America, a Mormon Example, with panelists Jeffrey O. Johnson, Lee Worthen, Vella Evans, and David Knowlton.
I'd like to welcome everybody. This panel is entitled The Way It Was, a look at D. Michael Quinn's Same-Sex Dynamics in 19th Century America, a Mormon Example. I'd like to welcome everybody here today, and particularly our panelists. I'll introduce myself. I'm Lee Worthen. I'm from the University of Utah Law Library, where I'm Assistant Director and Head of Public Services. I have a Juris Doctorate from BYU and a couple of Master's degrees from BYU, but I feel the least scholarly among this group. I dabble a bit in Utah history and Mormon history and in legal bibliography. We also have with us today Jeff Johnson, who is the archivist from the Archives of the State of Utah. Your program is a little bit deceptive there because it reads like he's the archivist at Utah State University, but that's not true. He's our Utah State archivist and is a very good historian, has a very fine history of publication and presentations to many groups like this. He's a familiar face at this on this kind of panel. We also have with us today Vella Evans, who is a PhD from the University of Utah. She teaches in the communications department, but she also teaches in women's studies, and she has published several interesting studies, including the most recent one I'm familiar with in Dialogue, which has to do with working women among LDS women. And also we have with us David Knowlton today, who is a PhD in anthropology, who is now at the University of Texas at Austin. And I think most of us probably know his history with BYU and probably needs the least introduction of any of us. Oh, I'm sorry. He got his degree from the University of Texas, and he's working in Salt Lake now. And then I'd like to recognize among us that we have D. Michael Quinn, who is the author of the book. And the way we'll proceed with this panel is that each member of the panel will make their presentation, and then we are handing out some little blue slips of paper, and we'd like to solicit your questions. Oh, all right, you've got some too. So we'd like to have you write your questions down, pass them to the middle of the aisle, and Brian or Perry will pick those up and bring them up to the panel, and then we can respond one or many of the panel. And Mr. Quinn has also agreed to respond to questions if you want to direct one to him. Is that correct? Okay. Well, I'm going to lead off. I thought I'd tell you a lot of jokes today, but I thought, well, considering the nature of the topic, maybe I'd play it straight. When I was a 20-year-old missionary just arriving in Austria from my small-town home in rural western Nebraska, I went through a certain amount of culture shock. One cultural difference I noticed soon after I arrived there was the custom of young women my age and younger, and I was 20 years old at the time, who would hold hands and embrace and even kiss each other. My wise old companion told me that it didn't mean a thing romantically. That it didn't mean that they were romantically involved. It was just a token of friendship. He also told me that I should not assume anything about the sexual preferences of men who bowed and gave dead fish handshakes or wore their top coats draped over their shoulders like capes. In some ways, this is essentially the message of same-sex dynamics among 19th century Americans, a Mormon Example. Michael Quinn warns us that we may be influenced by what he calls, quote, and other authors have called a, quote, presentist bias. In other words, we expect that during an earlier time, especially one as close as the 19th century, people basically shared our present behaviors, attitudes, and definitions. So coming from the biases of 1996, we have to understand differently a 19th century statement like Joseph Smith's that, quote, two who were very friends indeed should lie down upon the same bed at night, locked in each other's embrace, talking of their love, and should awake in the morning together. Quinn points out that, quote, it was socially and religiously acceptable for Mormon girls, boys, women, and men to walk arm in arm in public with those of the same gender. It was acceptable for Mormons to publicly or privately kiss those of their same sex, and it was okay, and he acknowledges it was also okay to acknowledge that they dreamed of doing it. Like American culture of the time, 19th century Mormonism approved and encouraged various levels of same-gender intimacy, which most Mormons experienced without an erotic response. I'm just going to kind of go through the book a little bit and tell you what's in it chapter by chapter. In the first chapter, that chapter is on cross-cultural perspectives, and in that one, Quinn warns us that what we understand to be homosexual behaviors are not necessarily regarded as such in other cultures. Nor do many in our own culture who have indulged in what our culture defines as homosexual behavior define themselves as homosexual. Cultures throughout history have not had our present concepts of sexual identity. In other words, they have not had our present concept of heterosexuality, because that's based on the definition of homosexuality, or homosexuality as states of being. In other words, people are not classified as homosexual or heterosexual. There are acts, but not classes of people that fit that. Quinn raises the question whether our concepts of homosexuality, heterosexuality, and bisexuality can even apply to everyone in our own society and time period, since they do not apply to even one other human society. Even though we assume that persons with exclusively same-sex desires have always existed, until the middle of the 19th century, European American culture did not acknowledge the existence of people whose erotic drives were only same-sex oriented. Quinn goes on to discuss comparative studies of Salt Lake and Copenhagen, and he points out that there are huge disparities between the number of men and women having same-sex experiences or desires, and that fact calls into question whether sexual orientation is even determined by genetics. He goes on in chapters 2-6 to describe various 19th century same-sex customs. These include what he calls the homosocial, which are primarily groups that are male-only association or female-only association. Then he talks about homopastoral, which is the same-sex or same-gender religious practices. For example, In Protestantism, religion was practically feminized, and men didn't really participate much. Whereas in Mormonism, we have male with male and female with female ordinances in the LDS Church, and even seating arrangements in the 19th century had the males sitting on one side and the females on the other side, and the children in the front. He talks about homotactile, which is a same-sex touching the sharing of beds, dressing, or kissing, and so on. And homoemotional, which are intense same-sex friendships, and apparently this was a sort of a vogue, particularly in the 19th century, and he particularly relates instances of what were called smashes between women who are attending all-women colleges. Same-sex friendships were sometimes homoromantic, in which there was a male-male or female-female love affair, but it wasn't necessarily erotic. He talks about homomatrimonial, where two members of the same sex were married, but most of his examples have to do with a female cross-dresser who marries a male. And female cross-dressing was fairly common, apparently, in 19th century America because of the benefits that accrued to men and not to women. And he talks about gender roles, particularly discusses the Native American burdosh. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. And he talks about cross-dressers, who usually were theatrical cross-dressers. And then he talks about a really fascinating thing, a same-sex marriage ceremony that was based on a mutual covenant between two people that's described by Willard Richards, who was the temple secretary in the Nauvoo period. And then he talks about the homo-environmental subcultures, which really amounts to a study of census records looking for possible homosexual couples. None of these chapters provide any conclusive evidence of homosexual or what Quinn would term homoerotic relationships between Mormons. They do point out that in such an atmosphere, behaviors that in the 1996 culture would look like homosexuality would not then have been interpreted as such. And as a corollary, that any relationships that in fact were erotic might very well not have been noticed. This is not to say that homoerotic relationships did not exist. Quinn quotes a physician by the name of G. Frank Layden, who wrote in 1889, quote, that there was in every community of any size a colony of male sexual perverts, that they are usually known to each other and are likely to congregate together. Now that's his language. That's Layden's language. With few exceptions, only the most strained and unsatisfactory inferences can be made that any particular individuals indulged in homoerotic behavior, and this includes those described in Chapter 9 as the coming out of three prominent Mormons in 1919, which the substance of which appeared in an article in Dialogue last winter, and talks about Evan Stevens and members of the primary general presidency, Louis B. Felt and May Anderson. And as you recall, that was the subject of some controversy in Cache County. We're told that we will, quote, recognize homoromantic and homoerotic subtexts and biographical articles about these individuals published in the 1919 Children's Friend, if we have, quote, the eyes to see it or the antenna to sense it. Much more satisfying evidence is presented in Quinn's analysis of Mildred J. Berryman's study of turn-of-the-century Utahns and Mormons who regarded themselves as homosexual, and many of whom were members of Salt Lake City's Bohemian Club. This forms the substance of Chapter 7 and much of Chapter 2 on the homosocial, and was previously presented by Michael at Sunstone in 1994. Chapter 9 is a discussion of homoeroticism and sex crimes in early Mormonism and Pioneer Utah. It concludes that while non-consensual sexual acts were severely punished, there was ambivalence or denial about consensual acts, and they were not even criminalized until fairly late in the century. Homoerotic activities were apparently considered less serious than heterosexual intimacy outside marriage or even masturbation. Chapter 10 discusses Utah responses to the trial of Oscar Wilde in 1895. It also documents criminalization or enforcement of laws against formerly accepted practices such as nude swimming, and provides year-by-year accounts of criminal prosecution, which also the previous chapter did. Quinn notes that, quote, during the 19th century, certain European-American writers created the view that, quote, the homosexual was now a species, end of quote, not just a regular person who happened to engage in sex with someone of the same gender. As a result, quote, romantic friendship disappeared between same-sex friendships in the 20th century as the sharp line was drawn between homosexual and heterosexual. He concludes that homophobia was not widespread in the 19th century Mormon community, but also notes that he found relatively few instances of homoerotic behavior when compared with studies done in the 1960s and 70s, about 400 times fewer for men and 175 times fewer for women. And he sees that disparity as most likely the result of an unwillingness or inability of early Mormons to recognize homoerotic behavior and the unwillingness to acknowledge the extent of non-marital sex generally. Chapter 11 dominates the change from relative tolerance to homophobia in the 20th century in Mormonism, particularly since the 1950s. Of several official responses to homosexual teaching or homosexual relationships, the most interesting described is that of Joseph F. Smith, who was the grandson of President Joseph F. Smith at the turn of the century. He was born in 1899. Smith, who had been appointed as an instructor at the University of Utah in 1926, had a relationship with a student by the name of Norval Service. Service married, and later Smith married, and President Heber J. Grant appointed him to be patriarch to the church in 1942. Apparently, Heber J. Grant did not know, and those who did know assumed that the president of the church didn't or had accepted the repentance of Joseph F. Smith. A little more than a year after Heber J. Grant's death, the first presidency and George Albert Smith released him because of his relations with a 21-year-old Mormon serving in the Navy. Joseph F. Smith was quietly sent to Hawaii, where by 1957 he was rehabilitated and restored to full church privileges. Now, by way of contrast, in a heterosexual relationship, 73-year-old Apostle Richard R. Lyman was excommunicated for an extramarital affair with a 71-year-old female friend. Now, I think that some strong points of the book are these. I guess I have a bias as a librarian, but the endnotes are just wonderful. They're a bibliographer's joy. They're so complete. Everything's in there. I know why he doesn't put them as footnotes, because they take up whole pages. Another thing that's very nice is an appendix that has a chronology of same-sex issues. Now, some things that I see as weaknesses in the book is I'm a little unclear about what the book is trying to do. Number one, it does show that customs and practices differed in the 19th century, and that's pretty clear. Number two, it does show that homoeroticism evoked a different response then than now. Number three, it does not show that homoerotic behavior was then acceptable it shows more that it was not recognizable than that it was acceptable, or else that its existence was denied. And number four, I have a little trouble in that it doesn't provide really any. I expected some startling revelations to come out of this book about some prominent Mormons, and there really weren't any. And the most it seems to accomplish is to show us that behaviors considered today indicative of homosexuality did not carry those meanings then. Now I want to talk a little bit about controversy, if there is any. Its title and the history of the publication might lead one to believe that it is controversial. However, the dynamics described in the book from the title are not controversial dynamics, I don't think. Now, relatives of Evan Stevens, of course he didn't have any descendants, were upset about conclusions drawn about him. However, the most recent delay in publication was about the copyright status of the photo used on the original dust jacket, which had to be removed from the finished books, reprinted, and then all the books had to be re-dust jacketed. Controversy has not yet materialized. Maybe it will here today. Two AP Press articles by Vern Anderson have not really provoked a lot of discussion. The most controversial thing, and I've passed these around, is an article in Out, which is a New York gay magazine, which very actively promotes a gay political agenda, that published the best short review of Quinn's book that I've read. However, its reviewer did not spark as much controversy as Quinn's statement to the interview, whose name is Michelangelo Signorilli. Quote, "I was married and have four children, and so I feel I'm part of a complicated interaction," he tells me. Quote, "I don't define myself as bisexual because I don't have an equal attraction to both genders. I am overwhelmingly attracted to men." I want to point out that these copies of the Out article are entitled The Secret History of Mormons, and they're being passed around, and I'd like to thank the author for permission to reproduce them for this audience. And I was going to say something that was a slam about reproduction, but I'll skip that and tell you thank you very much and turn the time over to our next presenter, who will be Jeff.
I've been sitting here remembering all the reasons I shouldn't be participating in this panel. I had all sorts of friends who said, "Don't get involved in this, Jeff," and I didn't pay any attention to that. I have had a long time interest in these issues, and particularly in the in Evan Stevens, and so I just ignored all the advice and jumped right in. But in the hallway, I found several people who were saying, "Now, what are you going to say here, Jeff, and why are you doing this?" So I think I'd like to make just a little introduction to say that I am supportive of this kind of research. I believe it's important to study all aspects of human life, and that I can really support and feel like that it's good to do this kind of research. I need to admit that it is not my usual position to be in to talk about these subjects, and so if I talk about things in such a way that offends anybody, please excuse me there, because it's just my perhaps ignorance rather than my intention to be rude. As I said, I have been longtime interested in Evan Stevens, have been interested in single men in Mormondom, being one myself, have published in 1983. When I look back, I thought, that's a long time ago. It seemed just yesterday to me. But I did an article called On the Edge, Single Men in Mormondom. And so I was caught by surprise when the controversy came up and when I read Quinn's article in Dialogue about some of the issues there. And so I'd like to discuss that. I could be talking a long time about this, but my desire is to talk, leave enough time for the rest of the panel, of course, and time for discussion. So I will focus on Chapter 8. Lee, it's Chapter 8, not Chapter 9. I looked through when he said that, but I was assured that it was Chapter 8. I would like to focus on Chapter 8, which talks about three Mormons, and they're coming out. I, as an archivist, would like to focus a little bit on the sources, too. This chapter was essentially discussed in an issue of Dialogue several issues ago, and I was surprised, having been familiar with the Children's Friend article and Stevens, that Quinn is calling this a way of Stevens, Feld, and Anderson to come out. Quinn says that starting with the October issue in 1919, the Friend devoted three remaining issues of the year to the same-sex dynamics of his teenage life. He says that these three prominent 19th century Mormons apparently came out in public at the height of their LDS church careers and did so in an official LDS magazine of October 1919. Perhaps I don't have the eyes to see or the antenna, and so maybe I am have a problem there. But I'd like to discuss those articles and their ramifications. As Quinn pointed out, Stevens was 65 in 1919, had been director of the Tabernacle Choir for from 1890 to 1916. The series of these articles were entitled Evan Bach, A True Story for Little Folk. Now this was a takeoff, Bach was a takeoff on the German composer, presumably because who was writing them was not really the issue, but that these stories were to be for children. And they were started in January that year and was to be published one each month in 1919. They started out to be very short and simple. Most of them were less than 2 pages. They were intended to be read by teachers to children in the primary association or by children themselves. And I need to digress by saying I think this was one of the problems with the articles. It was difficult for 65-year-old bachelor to write these articles in a way that the children would be interested in them. And so a lot of the strained language comes around that issue. Most of the stories were meant to have moral principles that the children could learn from when they read the stories. That was their intention. Chapter 1 started out with telling about the birthplace of this fictitious Evan Bach. But actually it's Evan Stevens' birthplace in Wells. The February story is entitled Our Little Welch Home. And the March story had a real lurid title, Rural Lovemaking in Wells. But it was a very innocent story of his brother's courting his brother courting a girl that became his brother's wife, and it's from the point of view of Stevens, who's a little boy in the story, and so to Evan Stevens, lovemaking was this courting process, and Evan Stevens watching it as a little boy. The April one was on the ocean, and May one was tragic death of Uncle Evan, remembrance of his uncle that he was named after. The June was thrilling experiences. That's the story of arriving in New York and seeing the excitement of New York City. July was beginning the 1,000-mile walk, and August was ending the 1,000-mile walk. And September was arrival in the valley. That brings us up to the October, November, and December article that Quinn feels Stevens is writing about the same-sex dynamics of his teenage life. I thought that I would read you some examples from these. I find that's very difficult to pull and be meaningful to you. Perhaps I could just tell you that the October one is entitled Enchantment of Friends and Music. And to me it seems to be just a continuation of the arrival one, because he's talking about his background of learning music. A quote here, he's talking about they went to Willard, is where his parents settled. He was the 10th child of his parents. And he says, in the small school and meeting house combined where the Sabbath and other services were held, Evan was enchanted by the singing of the splendid little choir. And he goes on and talks about the choir and the choir master, which to me, maybe I could read that. All day long these sweet songs rang in his ears. The kind, beaming face of David Tovey, the leader, persisted as a picture before him. Well, I really believe these are very much stories that he saw children reading, that he saw that they were to read and that the teachers would be in the primary would be reading to them. And so he describes this choir and the friendships that he had in the choir. And to me, they're not homoerotic at all. The next one was the November one was his learning music, and it's called Music Preparations. So it talks about what he did to learn music. And then the December one is called Enjoying the Fruits of Perseverance. And this points out to me the intention of this article is to teach children to persevere in their talents. Now, an example from this is where he says that the organist taught him how to play the organ. He gave him lessons. The result were many opportunities which these two friends talked over musical things. And soon they had a delightful little club of six members, meeting in the granary loft as often as they could spare time. The girls, as well as boys, climbed the ladder to the granary, where no nonsense was allowed to break into time and to studies. And then he goes on to say, this is an example for you that you should work hard develop your talents. This December article contained a finis, which was to end the 1919 series. But it also announced a new series, and it revealed to the readers who the writer was, Evan Stevens. When announcing the new series in 1920, the article states, "We are promised 12 separate articles from him," meaning Evan Stevens, "each covering one special interesting event in his life and labors specially written for the children's friend and the children." This new series was entitled Little Life's Experiences, True Incidents in the Life and History of Evan Stevens, written by himself. But it wasn't started until the February issue. In the introduction, he wrote, "Those readers, little or big, who have read the early life stories of Evan Bach appearing in the Children's Friend during the past 12 months, have become acquainted with me about my childhood in Wales and my traveling across the ocean, traveling across the plains, and my life in Willard as a boy learning music, learning how to sing." And he says, because these have been popular, he has been persuaded to continue writing it, though under his own name. And he says here, "The editor of The Friend has convinced me that this would be interesting. You may now, after all this, be interested in my relationship as some of the most interesting experiences in the past 50 years of my life. And so very much this second group of articles become reminiscences for him. And he's getting older, and so they are reminiscences that he feels are important, but also taking consideration who he's writing for. The first article is about snakes. He was afraid of snakes. When he came from Wales to Utah, they told him about snakes. And when he got to Willard, he met a snake, and this was very frightening for him. In March, he told about buying his brother's home in Willard and taking over that. In April, he talks about graduating from a boxcar when he was a railroad worker to a full-time musician, and he did that by becoming the director of the Logan State Tabernacle Choir. May talks about him moving to Salt Lake and him teaching here in Salt Lake. And then in June, he has a kind of a little interesting introduction. He says, "A little girlfriend of mine writes me, 'Dear Professor Stevens, we like your boyhood stories, but are eager for some that will tell us some of your experiences as a musician and choir leader.'" So in that series, he tells about the Tabernacle Choir's trip to the East, including them singing at the White House. In July, he goes back to this moral story, having a the World's Fair, and where the choir received the gold medal at the World's Fair. Well, why am I telling you all these things? I think we need to see these articles in context. And in context, and to my eyes, they look very much the same. They look very much like a middle-aged man talking about his experiences and trying to translate those experiences for primary for young kids and not confessing or coming out in them. He did not provide the 12 articles that was promised, and so in 1920, the October one about the World's Fair is the last one. Quinn identifies the issue in October as a particularly extraordinary affirmation of same-sex love and intimacy, because this issue also includes the biography of Louis B. Felt. It's not signed, but it's easy to tell that it was written by her and May Anderson. This article I'd like to discuss a minute, too. It is an unusually long article for the Children's Friend. It is 12 pages. Because it is long, and they put an outline at the end of it, because it's intended for the teachers to use this in primary. The outline is very interesting because I think that it shows what the authors intended be gotten out of this article, and it's very much a reconfirmation of Louis B. Felt as a model wife and a mother to children that was not her own, but her husband's children with his poor wives. The outline brings out those points. And to emphasize that, there is published a picture of Louis B. Felt with several of these children that were wives, or were children of wives of her husband. So it seems to me, particularly in this article, Quinn is misusing this as a coming out document, because the outline to me really confirms the traditional role of wife and mother. But that same article, that same issue also contains another article, and that is the biography of May Anderson. So in these three issues, we have in this one issue, we have a piece of biography of Evan Stevens, a large biography of Louis B. Felt, who by that time had been general president of the primary for, 40 years. And then a short biography of May Anderson. May Anderson's article is under the section called The Story Hour. Now, this was a regular section where there were stories given for teachers to use. In the introduction, it states, "Once more, the teacher has the opportunity to give the children a taste of the true Christmas spirit. So in October, they are giving information that they'll be prepared for their December Christmas. To teach them that those who serve the Lord best are those who do good to others." And it emphasizes May Anderson's service in the primary and, of course, her service to Louis B. Felt. She spent most of her life as Louis B. Felt's companion and living with Louis B. Felt. And the introduction says that this is to tell the children that they serve the Lord best by serving others. Along with that article is a picture of Feld and May Anderson, which is published in the book. It's right here in the center. And the caption under that picture is the David and Jonathan of the General Board. Quinn says, quoting Rocky O'Donovan, who O'Donovan was a student at the University of Utah and developed to the Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Utah. And as I understand, a close friend of Quinn. But Quinn quotes Donovan saying that this statement, that they were the David and Jonathan of the General Board, was a virtual announcement that Felt and Anderson were lesbians. So this picture is in this October 1919 friend. I have been unable to find any other authority which associates that phrase with lesbianism. Of course, it comes from the Bible, 1 Samuel, where the scripture is talking about the friendship between David, who was the future king of Israel, and Jonathan, who was the son of King Saul, the current king of Israel. During this period of time, as you remember in the Bible, David and Saul were having a hard time because there was this tension between David was to be his successor. And Jonathan always seemed to be the one to bring them together to help them be together. And it says in the Bible that Jonathan and David were very close and loved each other. But I think it's unusual to associate David with homoerotic behavior, because he has become the symbol of probably the ultimate heterosexual behavior, and that is seducing Bathsheba and having her husband Uriah killed. And Joseph Smith talked about David and all his wives and concubines being taken away from him because of this sin. I could also talk about Quinn uses Ruth and Naomi in the same sense in this chapter. And of course, as you read First Ruth, you realize that Naomi has lost her sons and her husband, and Ruth is committing herself to Naomi as a mother-in-law, and I assume not as a lesbian lover. I need to hurry. Sorry about this. There's a lot of things I could say. I do not believe that through these articles the general authorities were able to learn that these three people were gay. So I do not believe that they exhibited any intolerance in leaving them in their positions. There are a lot of things that I'd like to comment on. My time's up, so I'll just list them. It was not Stevens who said that Thomas was a blonde Viking who captured the eyes of everybody. Though, through the article, is talking about the blonde Viking Thomas who Evan Stevens helped and lived with. It was Harold Jensen who wrote that statement after Stevens was dead. And this brings it all around to me. I knew Harold Jensen, and I wished I'd been smart enough to say to him, tell me about Evan Stevens and his relationships with these young men. But that was long ago, and I had no idea to tell him. If I had time, I'd like to talk about the important issues of Stevens resigning for the Tabernacle Choir. If we had access to the church archives, we could find that these issues were very important and that they were very stressful for Stevens and the First Presidency. And the Quinn tends to say that it was a ruse for Evans to resign so he could go and live with Thomas in New York. But I think we know enough about this, and I got about this, that this resignation from the choir had a lot of roots in this conflict between Evan Stevens and the First Presidency. I think Stevens' will is very informative. One of the things you find out is that some of his closest friends were women that he gave things to in the will, and including widows of these young men that he had helped. If I had time, I'd comment about Stevens traveling and sharing rooms with other men. Single men are in a bind here. They can't share rooms with women, and it would have been unreasonable for Stevens to insist on having his own stateroom in these traveling. Heber J. Grant would never have allowed that. They just were very careful with the money they gave the choir. So all Stevens was able to do was to share rooms with men. I don't think that proves anything. I think his role as a music teacher for these men are important, and the way music was taught to them. I think I'd like to comment sometime on at least two of these men were close relatives of Stevens, and his desire to help them get ahead, I think, is really important. But there's one thing that I'm not qualified to talk about, and I think it should be talked about. If it's true that Stevens had homosexual relations with these young boys, I think it'd be interesting to comment on how easily these boys moved into heterosexual relationships and how Stevens was able to keep close relationships with them and their wives after they were married. But I think these issues are important, and I appreciate this book. But I think we need to have the best scholarly study, and I think that we need to look carefully at the sources and make sure the sources say what they say. Thank you.
My name is Bella Evans, and Lee, if you haven't read anything of mine since that dialogue article, and you have not read Reemerging Mormon Feminism, shame on you. Maxine Hanks is here. Tell him, Maxine. I also teach a course at the university titled Women in LDS Culture, and the course looks at gender issues in the church. I've just promised David that I'll stay tight with my manuscript. I can cover more in less time, so I will stay tight with my manuscript. It'll feel a little stiff if I do that, but I think it won't remain stiff. Same-sex dynamics among 19th century Americans, a Mormon example, is yet another testament to Michael Quinn's daunting scholarship. It reflects seemingly exhaustive research and opens to dialogue important issues including the social, doctrinal, and personal implications of gendered identity. There's much that I like and admire in the book. In the spirit of Adrienne Rich, Rich's lesbian continuum, Quinn softens the boundaries of the term homosexual by employing the more inclusive concept of same-sex dynamics. Under that rubric, he develops related concepts including homosocial, homoemotional, homotactile, homoromantic, and homoerotic. He recognizes the value of self-definition over imposed labels. In addition, Quinn and I agree that effort to understand those on the other side of the sexual orientation gulf fosters and deepens self-understanding. And we agree that learning of alien sexualities, his terms, in the earlier church connects readers with their heritage and with the present. However, I too am troubled by the book, and I too will look at chapter 8. This must be the chapter that's what all the fuss is about. While Quinn repeatedly cautions against any one true reading of the historical data, at times his own interpretations seem unjustifiably insistent. In addition, Mr. Quinn never problematizes the issue of outing other Mormons, even though the moral values of doing so deserve consideration. Examples of seemingly forced conclusions occur in several places, but I'll focus on chapter 8, a coming out, or an outing, of three prominent Mormons. Quinn defines coming out as, quote, making public reference to one's same-sex interests. But in his analysis, he often constricts the broad range of same-sex interests to homoerotic experience. For example, Quinn observes that while Tom S. Thomas lived openly with Evan Stevens in Salt Lake City, after he moved to New York City, Thomas did not list his East Village residence in the city directories. Quinn comments, Thomas apparently wanted to avoid the stigma of being called a New York fairy. At this time, Thomas, a medical student at the University of Columbia University, was apparently living with seven other male students, not an uncommon practice. And there are many reasons to avoid listing in city directories. Quinn also makes much of the first half of Stevens' poem, Friends, published in a 1920 Children's Friend magazine. The first two lines read as follows. We have lived and loved together, slept together, dined and supped. Mr. Quinn claims the poem shows that each of these young men, apparently the seven named beneficiaries in Stevens's will, shared Stevens's bed. However, does the plural pronoun we that opens the poem refer to all of the beneficiaries, as Quinn claims, some of them, any one of them? Or might it refer only to the poem's persona and an unnamed someone else? Evan Stevens consistently defined his housemates and friends as boy chums, while Quinn once uses boyfriend and once live-in boyfriend. This substitution may reflect an historical shift in sensibility that Mr. Quinn himself prescribes. On page 3, he warns against a presentist bias or interpreting historical experience to fit contemporary meanings. However, presentist expectations seem apparent in Quinn's discussion of Louis B. Felt and May Anderson. Quinn observes that Felt, general president of the Primary Association, and Anderson, her first counselor, had lived together from 1889 until 1923. In interpreting the nature of that relationship, Quinn draws almost exclusively on two biographical sketches, neither carrying a byline, in the October 1919 Children's Friend. Of the century, Mormon culture was highly tolerant of same-sex physical intimacy. He still concludes that the women's photo, titled The David and Jonathan of the General Board, is evidence of a probable homoerotic relationship. In his reading of the photo, Quinn calls attention to the fact that Felt is so close to Anderson that her breast was touching Anderson's shoulder. In my own last week's survey of a half dozen volumes of Relief Society magazines and young women's journals of the same period, women in most photos were close enough that one's breast would touch another's shoulder, arm, or back. However, I did find no photos of two women only. Data's not as good. Quinn further develops his case for a probable homoerotic relationship between Felt and Anderson by quoting from what he claims is Anderson's third-person autobiographical sketch. In this piece, Anderson states that their friendship ripened into love. And she adds, "Those who watch their devotion to each other declare that there never were two more ardent lovers than these two. And strange to say, during this time of love feasting, Mary changed her name to May, because that seemed to be more agreeable to both." Mr. Quinn focuses on three elements from this short section: the phrases love feasting, ardent lovers, and the change of Mary's name to May. Regarding the latter, Quinn writes, "In establishing their new relationship, the younger woman publicly took a different name, as would a new bride, rather than adopting a private nickname between close friends." However, the very anthropologist Mr. Quinn cites so frequently in Chapter 1 also note that individuals often take on a new public name to mark life passages, particularly the passage into adulthood. In addition, studies of 19th century slavery and employment practices reveal the frequent public name changes of persons entering another's employ or keeping. Mary Anderson met Louis Felt when the former was just leaving her teens, and she joined the more prestigious Felt household to assist with domestic work. All common reasons to shift from Mary to May. Mr. Quinn claims regarding love feasting and ardent lovers might be challenged by his own and quite frequent recognition throughout the book of the warm language between friends that was common to persons born in the 19th century. Victorian prose is florid, as Quinn himself admits, and many terms held less sexualized connotations in 1919 than they hold today. Both the 1913 and 1944 dictionaries I consulted defined love feast as a meal taken in token of brotherly love and charity. The 1913 and 1929 dictionaries had no clearly sexualized usages for lover. Only the 1944 volume includes, at the end of its listings, a person with sexual passion for another and a paramour. Mr. Quinn draws the following from Felt's sketch as additional evidence of probable homoerotic experience. So here apparently is the primary president writing about herself and the other woman. "When they were too tired to sit up any longer, they put on their bathrobes and crawled into bed to work until the wee small hours of the night." Quinn then observes, quote, "It is difficult to overlook the erotic dimension of that acknowledgement when coupled with the magazine's statement that, quote, there never were two more ardent lovers than these two," end quote. Well, most contemporary Mormon women or non-Mormon women would overlook the erotic in that scene. Camp counselors, general board members traveling on assignment, students and scholars continue to work on their daytime interests in their bathrobes in one bed at night. I know Mr. Quinn will support these criticisms he's hearing. He notes that all the time. He consistently says the language was different, the times were different, the culture was homosocial, the culture was homoromantic. He also notes that most Mormons living at the turn of the century experience considerable same-gender intimacy without an erotic response. He admits that the period's warm language between friends covered a multitude of relationships, and that for the vast majority of Mormons, the 1919 children's friend passed, good one, without notice. Quinn himself writes that the historical evidence does not demonstrate sexual intimacy. And he also admits that his conclusions are a matter of speculation. Then what are the values in his outing of three prominent Mormons? Some negatives are already apparent in the eyes of our highly homophobic society. Three once prestigious Mormons have been vilified. There is denial, threat of lawsuits, outrage, and pain. I personally am much more concerned that Mr. Quinn has appropriated the discourse of self-definition and clarified meanings to suit his own purposes. Once again, marginalized persons are silenced or their perceptions translated. In addition, by consistently nudging the relatively broad notion of same-sex interests in the limited direction of homoerotic experience, Mr. Quinn hardens the boundaries around the concepts homosexual and same-sex dynamics and implicitly naturalizes the categories. In the words of historian Joan W. Scott, the project which so worthily set out to historicize the category ends up essentializing and reifying it. As a result, oppressive structures are perpetuated. On the other hand, if readers accept Quinn's argument and maintain appreciation for the lives and contributions of these early Mormons, then our history, ourselves, and our community are considerably enriched.
Well, we're swiftly running out of time, and so I'm going to try to be very brief. I don't have a text because I was just recently got back from South America and was pressed onto the panel, but I'm delighted to do it. Mike has tackled a very difficult task, as I gather you're aware. He writes at a particular time and place, that is this time and place, the time when our state legislature recently went bonkers, forgive the vernacular, went absolutely bonkers over the fact that some teenagers wanted to form a school club and they claimed gay identity. The legislature's fear, evidently, was that there was sex going on of one sort or another. We live in a time when many scholars have said that our popular religion, our dominant religion, is a religion of sex. Religion in an interesting way. That sex becomes a value, sex becomes a focus, sex becomes an emphasis, sex becomes what we fight against, sex becomes what we reject, and sex becomes where we draw lines among groups of people. Mike writes in the context of a very strong literature about a past that is in many ways another culture. He writes about a past, and this provides a very difficult task for him as a historian, because he writes about a past where there were no homosexuals or even heterosexuals. He attempts to capture the moment when heterosexuality and homosexuality develop as discourses and then create, not in an idealist sense, I'd have to go through a long theoretical explanation to cover that, but create through social interaction or through the social application of the terms, categories of people as if they were almost distinct species, to use the words that Mike writes about. He locates himself in a literature that discusses the history of things like sexuality, the development of the terms of sexuality, development of particular focuses in terms of the meaning of sexuality. Unfortunately, he does not spend enough time, in my opinion, describing the broader literature on the history of sexuality. And I think his book would be a richer work were he to spend a bit more time on that. He does an ample job, an excellent job, of describing different constructions of sexuality in other societies. He's certainly done his homework in the anthropological literature, and I commend him for that. Mike attempts, though, in this context where you have a dual structure of two kinds of people, heterosexual and homosexual, to write about something different. I agree with our last speaker. I think he tries admirably, and I think ultimately his text is imbricated throughout by the very dualism he tries to eschew. Case in point, the very context of homoerotic comes too close to meaning homosexual over and over again. Eros comes to mean sex. And as a result, it takes the term eros and gives it much of the meaning of the term sex. I'm not going to take the time to go into this text and show you instance after instance of this. And I think that does a disservice to his argument. But on the other hand, why is he attempting this? Why is he doing it? Mike is trying to find an objective emetic, in the anthropological term, for describing the behaviors of the past to get at the kinds of intimacies, interactions, the nature of human life, the silences, to use Mike's term, that created a society that was radically different, where people interacted in a different way than we can, because our society is divided dually, and that interferes with everything we do. Mike is trying to talk about a different time. And to do that, he goes to an objectification, in the sense that he wants to talk about homotactile, homopastoral. Let's forget for a minute the composite nature of these terms and how problematic they are. When homo means same, it doesn't mean homosexual. And if it does mean homosexual, then it's importing all the way back the dualism once again, implicitly. But let's forget that for a moment. By going to the objective, Mike is falling into another discourse of essentialization, which is part of the politics of current sexuality that argues that sexuality is inherent and that sexuality is also gender-based, that sexuality is natural. Let me insist as a social anthropologist that none of the above are true. Sexuality is neither inherent, natural, nor objective. Sexuality is contingent, transformable, and constantly redefined by societies in many different complexes, depending on how society draws boundary lines. I think one of the biggest absences of Mike's book is a chapter on friendship. He talks about marriage. He never defines for us what marriage is. Let me say as an anthropologist again that marriage in some societies is a contractual relationship among two different kin groups. Mike will go into the anthropological literature, borrowing from other people to be sure, talking about marriage among people of the same gender. But what does marriage mean in this context? What does marriage mean at itself in any context? He doesn't provide us an answer. As a result, he leaves the category of marriage essentialized, problematic, and something that imports, once again, a polemical discourse from the present into the past that I find troublesome. Along that note, let me also mention, Mike makes mistakes on the ethnographic present. The ethnographic present is an artifice that was used in anthropology in the early part of the century to describe peoples as if they were essential groups so we could get at their culture and talk about them as if they were timeless. But every anthropology student learns that what you first have to know is when is that ethnographic present? What are they writing about? Now, there's a problem in this usage because it makes past societies appear present. And at the same time, it denies current people their past. Let me give you one example, and this will be the only example I'm going to go to the text. On page 131, Mike says, some sub-African peoples also have man-boy marriage. Then further down in the paragraphs, these African boy wives were between, so on. His change of tense is significant because he's talking about things that are in flux and change. Every society on Earth has been influenced to one degree or another by this insistent dualism. People have dealt with it in many different ways. But by this confusion of the ethnographic present, Mike, unfortunately, is denying people their own past and denying us the ability to historicize completely contextual changes. Now, to be sure, what he's trying to do is show us, a Mormon audience and an American audience, that things were radically different in the past. But let me go back to my point. I think he needs would be better served by doing a long discussion of a whole range of categories that were important at the time and talk about changing categories over time instead of trying to impose seemingly objective categories that are important to the past, current dynamics. Now, I'm not troubled by Chapter 8. I find Chapter 8 almost to be irrelevant. I think the book would be better without it, to be honest with you. That's the controversial chapter. I don't think it's important to say who is or who is not gay, straight, whatever, at any given historical point. It has political interest. It's historical. It's certainly prurient. It's going to be one of the biggest reasons the book is bought, that people want to know, they want to see. But from an anthropological point of view, from my anthropological point of view, the more important issue and the most important theme of this book, and I think this is where I need to give Mike the Sunday school gold star, if you will, is that he talks about the major change in society. From a past where things were understood differently to a present where the very mention of the word homosexual is enough to make some people start salivating with rage and engage in all kinds of political strange actions. From a past where people were not understood as necessarily essential beings in terms of their sexuality, because sexuality was understood differently, to a present where we need to control sexuality according to political arguments because the fate of society hangs on what people do in the privacy of their own home. Now, I find current political discourse extremely problematic, but that would be a lecture for another time. There's much more I could say. Let me end and leave the time for Mike. I do want to commend Mike. I think he's done a masterful work. I'm not a historian, so I'll leave to the historians the debating over footnotes and interpretation of texts. But let me say that in terms of the literature, the broader literature, Mike fits himself very nicely into that literature. And as a result, his argument that same-sex dynamics were different in the past is not really strange, and that Mormons were like other Americans should not surprise any of us. What we're in face of is a time when we're looking at a different country, the past. And I think Mike does that beautifully. I just wish he'd done it a little better. But thank you.
We'd like to take this time for questions, and if you still have papers with questions on them, will you please pass them to the center aisle? Okay, the first one is a question for Michael Quinn. Why were the books reprinted? Mike, do you want to come up?
I appreciate the time and effort that the various panelists have given to the book and to their comments. I'll just make a few general comments about their comments. In the index, I think the index indicates the kind of emphasis that I make throughout the book. And in focusing, for example, on a particular chapter, like chapter 8 comes as chapter 8. There is more than half the book that precedes it and establishes a number of the points of view that are necessary in order to understand the context in which I'm talking about Evan Stevens and Louis B. Feld and May Anderson. For example, in the index under Chum, I close a parenthesis that as meaning a term for close friend. There are 13 page entries. Under co-residence of same-sex persons, there is a statement, not in itself proof of homoerotic relationship, 8-page references. Under friendship, I simply cross-reference that, see same-sex intimacy without homoeroticism. Under homo-emotional, I cross-reference that among the cross-references, see platonic love. Under platonic love, there are 7-page entries, and then also a cross-reference to same-sex intimacy without homoeroticism. And then same-sex intimacy without homoeroticism, there are 14-page references. Which is to say that when I repeatedly in the book indicate that when I talk of intimacy between friends, I'm not talking about down and dirty sex. And when I talk about friendships, and there's a long discussion I give to David and Jonathan relationships and how that's used in 19th century American society. I point out that is typically understood to be platonic, and I define what platonic means. So there is a problem, I think, in perceptions of, I think, of people who are responding to some parts of the book, who are bringing their own preconceptions and ignoring very emphatic statements I make in setting up a definition and in trying to establish an understanding of an earlier worldview, understanding my comments about that earlier worldview are really important in order to understand the examples that I give, such as Evan Stevens or a number of the others that I talk about. Concerning the issues of establishing a different time and place and trying to understand that different time and place within our dialogue and our worldview. That is enormously difficult no matter what the topic you're trying to do. whatever the topic is that you're trying to communicate to others. Because you are constantly, whether you're looking at medieval Europe, whether you're looking at pre-contact or pre-Columbian contact America, you're continually having to depend on the vocabulary that you know and that your readers know, or even that you are trying to refine for your readers, and apply that vocabulary, which has a particular cultural reference, to describing a completely different world. And we're prisoners of the vocabulary. We're prisoners of our own cultural perceptions. And whenever you're trying to understand a different people or a different time frame, you're constantly, as an author or as a reader, caught between the necessities of current language and trying to adapt that current language to a different worldview that didn't have that language or those language assumptions. And so I'll have to plead guilty to not being adequate to a task that I, in some ways I think is impossible, to fully communicate in the language of a current culture and a current worldview an understanding of a different culture and a different worldview. The best that you can do is approximate it, and I tried to come up with what I felt were value-neutral phrases that would help the reader and myself to capture a very different world. And I'm not even talking, as David Knowlton pointed out, just one very different world. I'm talking about very different worlds, cultures, peoples who themselves change over time and become difficult even within their own cultures to understand over a time period, and we are trying to understand them, and yet they are also dynamic societies that have changed as well. So the enormous challenge of the task I certainly acknowledge, and that I didn't fully achieve that I will acknowledge too. But I do feel I made the best effort that I think I could within the limits of language to do that. The other thing that I'll point out and that I acknowledged right in the introduction is that once you establish the data, even if you and a variety of readers can agree what the set of data is, once you establish those data, there are going to be conscientious differences in how one person, one group of people, interprets and understands that data than another group will. And I acknowledge that. And I have tried throughout the book to acknowledge that there are different alternatives for the response to the various data that I present. So I don't want to say more in specific about the individual comments that members of the panel gave, except to point out that in some senses I think I tried to anticipate those by acknowledging that there were different ways of responding to the data than the way I respond. I do think, however, I do want to comment on one thing, and that is this this quote, and actually it's not my words, it's quote, those who have the ears to hear or the antenna to sense a second level of meaning. That came from a biography of Amy Lowell, who was a well-known, during her own lifetime, well-known lesbian American poet who wrote a great deal of same-sex love poetry, much of it in honor of her longtime partner, Ada Dwyer Russell, who was a famous Utah Mormon actress who became her live-in character or live-in companion. And the characterization of Amy Lowell's poetry was what was being quoted. And whenever you're dealing in discourse, particularly literary discourse, with multiple levels or the possibility of multiple levels, that always is going to be controversial. But it has nothing to do with the audience the presumed audience that it is directed to. For example, much has been said concerning the articles about Evan Stevens and Louis Buffelt being published in a children's magazine, being directed to children's friends, or rather to children and teachers of young children. I'll simply point out that three of the most famous children's stories, bedtime stories, had very different purposes in the intent of their authors. Gulliver's Travels, The Wizard of Oz, and